Chapter 6 Day 3 in Jail. A good head and a good heart are always a formidable combination. Nelson Mandela. Sunday, November 20th, 2011. By Sunday morning's breakfast call at 5:45 a.m., the rain outside was a steady white noise, and Mikovits knew she was not getting out that day. The arrest at home on Friday had blindsided everyone, as there was no arrest warrant. By Saturday, in her jail cell, she felt angry, mystified, and increasingly sad. By Sunday morning, these had muted into a dull resignation. Mikovits gazed out the small window at the top of her cell. She saw tops of rows of lemon trees outside, discerned a hazy rim of the mountains in the distance, and watched the sheets of rain coming down. The guard led them out, and after grabbing their breakfast trays, she and Marie went back to the cell. Mikovits picked at her food. Marie ate quickly and then dozed off. Mikovits could only flash back to recent events. Months after her October 2009 publication in Science, the staff at WPI had chatted anxiously about how to respond to the increasing controversy over the association between XMRV and MECFS. Beyond the discovery of HTLV-1 and 2 and HIV, the field of retrovirology had been a quiet player in human disease investigations, but those retroviruses, particularly HIV, were scientific bombshells. The press exploded after the Science publication, and some officials seemingly did covert damage control, with Dr. William Reeves from the Centers for Disease Control's MECFS program proclaiming to the New York Times about her research, "If we validate it, great. My expectation is that we will not." Annette was a fan of the 2009 movie Invictus, which detailed how in his post-prison years, Nelson Mandela had launched a charm offensive, using white South Africans' rugby fanaticism as a way to bring factions of the country together after apartheid had ended. With Morgan Freeman as Mandela and Matt Damon playing the captain of the South African rugby team during the World Cup, the movie had moved Annette to the point that she had encouraged Judy, who wasn't a film buff, to recruit the entire staff to watch it. Mikovits saw the movie on a flight shortly after a conversation early in 2010 with Annette. "We know that groups like the CDC and the NIH have, in the past, screwed up their investigations into this disease, but we want to bring them along," Annette had said. "We want them as our partners. If the CDC has a probe we can use, then we take it. If the NIH wants to help, we'll let them. Let's try to make everybody a winner." It seemed possible to quilt together ideas, as had been done in AIDS, once the initial resistance and prejudice was overcome. In a field where discoveries were often sidetracked by ego grabs, the two women wanted to show collaborative potential for the common good. Though MECFS was often dismissively called a wastebasket diagnosis, early AIDS might have been similarly pegged if it wasn't bogged down in other insulting misnomers, such as gay-related immune deficiency, GRID, since its initial presentation seemed beyond belief. The so-called wastebasket mislabeling was in fact the basis for a lot of the prejudice against MECFS patients, leading to the false impression that patients could not possibly have so many diverse symptoms in one body. As patient writer Jody Bassett stated in her article, ME, The Shocking Disease, "People say it's too severe and there are too many symptoms. The entirely unique way we respond to even trivial exertion and are so disabled by it, instead of inspiring sympathy, seems to actually inspire disbelief. People seem to bizarrely believe that there must be some limit on how bad a disease could be, and that such severe illness couldn't be possible long term. A retrovirus theory for ME/CFS, as with AIDS, created a unifying thread, since it made essentially every co-infection hypothesis workable, as these could now be viewed as secondary infections. AIDS, as opposed to just HIV infection, was in fact defined as HIV plus one of 20-odd co-infections and CD4 counts below 200, with the bugs attacking a patient after the immune system was wrecked by HIV. The resemblance of ME/CFS to AIDS was unmistakable. AIDS patients often had active co-infections in the herpes virus family, Mycoplasma, Candida, all found to be overrunning the body in ME/CFS by doctor pioneers such as Dr. Martin Lerner, who biopsied heart tissue of ME/CFS patients and found opportunistic infections such as cytomegalovirus, CMV, and HHV6, as well as Lyme and Babesia. Babesiosis, CMV, and HHV6 are also known to run rampant in AIDS, and Lyme is caused by a spirochete just like syphilis, which occurs in AIDS. Lerner's story was like that of Chiron, the mythological wounded healer, as his eureka moment about ME/CFS and heart infections came after his own heart was infected and he treated himself with antiviral drugs. Other tick-borne co-infections, such as Bartonella, are also found in both AIDS and ME/CFS. In AIDS, an association was even found between Bartonella henselae and the progression to neuropsychological symptoms and dementia. Bartonella in AIDS patients was studied fairly early on in the pandemic because of the tragic fact that some people with AIDS, seeking comfort in a pet, had contracted it from cat scratches. Immune abnormalities in natural killer cells, RNAs L and clonal expansions of T cells in ME/CFS, also paralleled the immune dysregulation recorded in AIDS and could be retroviral in origin. Even John Coffin from Tufts University discussed the potential new linkage between retroviruses and ME/CFS in his early commentary on the Science paper. Coffin temporarily saw they were looking through a sharper lens at old history, and in retrospect, the connections between ME/CFS and a retrovirus were obvious. Around 11:30, that familiar call came over the cell's speaker. Mikovits, prepare for a visitor. As if to add to the feeling that the jail was some kind of wastebasket, a place for the socially forgotten, nobody else on the cell block had had a single visitor but her. She snapped into the routine this time. She had the booking number sheet in her pocket and put her hands behind her back and covered her signet ring with a finger. The door to the cell opened, and Mikovits knew to wait at the entrance for the guard now. From where she stood at attention, she could see the circular free time room and some of the inmates sitting at the steel picnic tables. Although the faces were fuzzy without her glasses, she saw the woman at the table nearest to her take notice of her. "Can you help me?" the woman asked imploringly. Mikovits recognized Ruth, the woman who had entered the holding cell sobbing and coughing on Friday night. Mikovits surveyed the scene to see if any of the guards were witnessing this. She had noticed that they didn't seem to mind prisoners communicating, so she chanced it. "What do you need?" she replied. "You have a visitor?" asked Ruth. "You're going to see someone now?" "Yeah, in a minute. I have to get word to my family and to my work. They expect me to be there or I'll be fired. I have to keep my job." "Your family only has cell phones?" Mikovits asked, remembering how difficult it was for her to make contact with David from the holding cell initially due to the restriction from calling cell phones. But the rules were different at the Todd Road facility, allowing cell phone calls. "Yes, my daughter has a landline phone, but I only got the answering machine." Mikovits imagined the phone ringing at the daughter's home, the message machine picking up, and the robotic voice that David would later parrot saying, "Message from inmate, Ventura County Jail." Ruth did not seem like a repeat offender. Like Mikovits, she looked shocked to be there, a little too pliable for the atmosphere, traumatized. Her daughter probably had no idea her mother had been picked up by police. "What do you need me to do?" "I work as a checker at a grocery store in Thousand Oaks. Call and tell them Ruth is sick, but she will try to be there tomorrow. I will call them when I can. I have the bail money. In my purse I have money, but it was taken from me. If somebody can make bail, I can pay them right back." Mikovits knew the woman's bail was probably only a few $100s. "What are the charges against you?" "Driving under the influence. But I wasn't drinking. I was sick with a cold. I took NyQuil, but it did not help my coughing, and it was keeping my husband awake. He was angry and cranky because he had to go to work early the next morning. He told me to go to the store and get better cough syrup. Cops picked me up on the way to the store. I shouldn't be here." "I'll do my best," said Mikovits just before the guard ambled up. Mikovits put her hands behind her back and placed one finger over her signet ring to conceal it, and made her way to the visiting room. Ruth was all smiles as she passed, exclaiming, "Thank you," as the guard cast them both a curious look. David and Sherilyn Littleton, a dear friend from their church, Community Presbyterian, the parishioners call it CPC, in Ventura, sat on the other side of the glass. Mikovits grabbed the phone handset hurriedly, and David mirrored her on the other side. He asked if she was okay. She mentioned to him that she hadn't been able to brush her teeth since Friday night when they had given her a small packet of toothpaste. David knew there was a general store for the inmates and had gotten the paperwork to set up an account for her, but it would not open until Monday morning. Another day stretched before her without a way to brush her teeth, but it was just another indignity. Any time an inmate complained, the guards reminded her that jail wasn't a resort. David looked like he had not slept. The lines on his forehead were little crevices behind his icy-looking skin. He gave the phone over to Sherilyn, who said, "Judy, everybody has been praying for you. We can't believe this." Sherilyn and her husband Emmett were deacons at CPC. She was part of a group that visited hospitals and prayed with people before surgery. Strong in her faith, Sherilyn typically contained her emotions to soothe those patients. When she saw the surreal image of her friend behind glass, she could see Judy was about to break into tears. Sherilyn tried to steer her friend away from emotion, to protect David, who seemed fragile. Sherilyn and Emmett had met David at CPC well before they had ever seen Judy. David would rave about the fabulous woman he had met who lived back east, while Sherilyn teased him that Judy was just an imaginary girlfriend. They finally all connected at a Super Bowl party in 2001. And Sherilyn took an instant liking to the scientist. The couples traveled together, and Judy enthusiastically volunteered for the church's charitable activities. "I know, Sherilyn, I'm in shock about it too. Please tell everybody I'm okay." "I will take care of David," said Sherilyn. "He's frightened about these horrific events, but he has so many caring friends, don't you worry." Sherilyn was having trouble envisioning what improbable set of circumstances had landed her friend in jail. Judy was a big-hearted person. David gushed about her compassion. "I wouldn't be surprised to come home and find somebody sleeping in our living room," he joked, soliciting guffaws from those who knew Judy's open heart meant an open-door policy. She and David slept on the sofa, endured the bad backs in the morning, and gave up their own bed for whomever they had welcomed in. Sherilyn hated to see her friend like this. Mikovits knew how bedraggled she must look dressed in her orange jumpsuit with her unkempt hair, her breath surely questionable. She was grateful there were a couple inches of thick glass since she wasn't so minty fresh. David looked to be on the edge of crumbling. "Can I have him for a minute?" she asked her friend. Sherilyn handed David the phone. Sherilyn could only hear one side of the conversation, but it was vintage Judy. "You want me to do what?" David asked. Back in the free time room, Judy saw Ruth again. "So, did you talk to him?" she asked. "Yes, he's calling your employer." Mikovits glanced suspiciously around to see if their conversation was attracting the guard's attention. "Oh, I am so relieved, thank you," exclaimed Ruth. "Were you able to talk to him about my bail?" "Yes, that too. Let me give you his cell phone number. He now knows your situation and maybe can do more." David and Sherilyn were at a nearby restaurant decompressing from their experience when the call from Ruth came in. David thought it was his wife and accepted the collect call, but quickly figured out it was her jailmate. He reassured Ruth that her workplace had seemed sympathetic about her health. He was a little bewildered by her request to help her make bail, but knew his wife would want him to do something. He drove Sherilyn to her house through the still pounding rain and then headed over to the courthouse to talk to a bail bondsman. The process took over an hour, and then he needed to wait for Ruth to be driven over from the Todd Road facility so that he could escort her home. Prisoners also had to have someone pick them up once bail was posted. Ruth's car, her family's only car, had been impounded. At about 7 in the evening, while Mikovits was in the free time room, she saw Ruth enter the area with her box of possessions and her folded-up thin mattress that could have been a Pilates mat under better circumstances. Ruth nodded to Mikovits, mouthing an exaggerated thanks as the guard hurried her out. Mikovits thought for a moment about the narrow line between freedom and incarceration, between wellness and a virulent disease. Virologist Robin Weiss once wrote, "If Charles Darwin were alive today, he might be surprised to learn that humans are descended from viruses as well as from apes." On a cellular level, there really was a pretty thin separation between inside and outside, self and other. People were made up of their interrelationships, from the cell block to the world outside, from the virus to the inner machinery of a human cell. Interrelationships were the essence of life, both good and bad, and perhaps this is why the simple act of connecting with another inmate made the day feel lighter. Mikovits knew what a gentleman David was. He would immediately offer to carry Ruth's box for her, with the kind of simple sweetness that could push a person to tears after an ordeal like jail. He would also be upbeat, making pleasant small talk to keep Ruth at ease. He came across as both caring and incredibly non-threatening to strangers, which had attracted Mikovits when she met him in 1999 and he was the human resources director of a local hospital. The difference between David and some HR folks is that he really did see all people as resources, much like his wife did. Mikovits had an indulgent moment of self-pity, since this time she wasn't the lucky one. She had not seen a lawyer, nor even heard from one. She had talked to the astonished bail bondsman who proclaimed that in all of his years he had not seen a bail hold for somebody in her situation. She wondered if she should call David tonight, but at $10 a minute, what would she say other than tell him how distraught she was? In her helplessness, she felt perturbed. Why hadn't he been able to bail her out? As her thoughts churned, Mikovits heard a woman's voice singing a religious melody loudly in the background, with erratic pitch. She recognized the song as Praise God. Mikovits glanced up and saw the wiry inmate with a mop and bucket and spray bottles working on the shower. Her tune seemed so happy, defying the surroundings. She didn't mind at all if she skipped half the words, humming through verses. She kept time by slopping the mop on the tile, circling it around, wringing it out, singing her mop microphone karaoke. Mikovits felt spurred to do something. She walked over and asked, "Do you want some help?" Her jailmate was in her early 30s, thin with cropped dark hair, looking like somebody who might have thrilled down highways on a Harley or two. Mikovits later learned the woman was in jail for stealing a truck, a story that, like many of the stories she heard in jail, contained a few murky particulars. "Sure," said the woman jovially, and handed Mikovits some of her cleaning items. "Just follow me." The woman returned to scrubbing out the shower and resumed her singing while Mikovits began wiping down the sink. "Where did you get these supplies anyway?" Mikovits asked. "Oh, you just ask the guards and they'll give them to you. You don't think the guards clean up, do you? They leave that to us." Mikovits hadn't even considered this. They scrubbed for a few more minutes, and Mikovits marveled at her new acquaintance's beautiful work. "You're a pro at this," she said. The woman let out a hearty laugh and said, "Well, I should be. I do it for a living." "Oh, that's great. My place is a mess." Mikovits flashed to imagine her ransacked home. "Maybe when you get out of here, I can hire you." The woman gave her a wily little smile, as if aware of the absurdity of their situation, and said, "Sure, I'm always looking for work." Again, Mikovits hoped the movement would help her sleep. Earlier in the day, she thought walking quickly up and down the stairs between the two levels would tire her out. But actual work was something different. It got into the bones in a deeper way. They were nearly finished with the second level when Mikovits, on a whim, decided to take a minute to watch the football game on television. She loved watching sports, from basketball at the UVA to the minor league Reno Aces baseball team. Mikovits had even been a Nets special guest at Game 5 of the 2010 World Series when the San Francisco Giants won the series for the first time in history. In the picture they emailed to Frank Rossetti, they looked as the happiest of sisters. Who would have guessed that 1 year later, Judy would be jailed by her sister? Harvey, a lifelong Giants fan, often ribbed Mikovits that he had given up his seats to her and had never gotten to see his beloved team at the World Series because he was too busy fighting foes for Annette and Judy. But she wasn't in the bleachers at Pac Bell Park now, just straining by the second-level railing at the Todd Road facility to see the game on the small TV. She leaned out over the atrium to make out the scoreboard. "Suicide!" A shrieking call came over the loudspeakers. Mikovits peered around at the sudden, sped-up motion, heard the thud-thud-thud of the guards' hurried footsteps, the crisp steel door from the tower swinging open. Her initial thought was that someone had been found blue in a cell and guards were rushing in to perform CPR. In another split second, she realized they were looking squarely at her. "Stand back from the rail," warned the guard who was now just about 10 feet away from her, warily holding hands out in a protective stance and angling in a slight squat toward her. Her cleaning partner intervened. "Oh, honey, don't you know you can't stand there?" Just beyond the rail, it was open air and a 10-foot drop to the first level of the free room. The guard looked at the other inmate, searching for validation that Mikovits wasn't going to make a suicide attempt. I'm sorry, mumbled Mikovits. I just wanted to see the score, and my eyesight isn't so great, so I was just leaning. She quickly stopped blathering and backed away from the edge. Then the guard immediately relaxed her posture. The free time area, focused on the drama for a minute, went back to buzzing with conversation. Mikovits went over to her jailmate and picked up the cleaning supplies, shaken. What a crazy day for a scientist, from the early rooster call to being viewed as an imminent suicide risk. Like jails, viruses themselves were also freedom snatchers, basically inert until they invaded a host cell and then doled out rules, parameters, and behaviors for the host to follow. As much as free will actually mattered, viruses seemed to hijack it on a cellular level. As Michael Spector wrote in The New Yorker, viruses reproduce rapidly and often with violent results, yet they are so rudimentary that many scientists don't even consider them to be alive. A virus is nothing more than a few strands of genetic material wrapped in a package of protein, a parasite, unable to function on its own. It was easy to imagine how, given this zombie-like depiction, those with ME/CFS could feel like the living dead. Viruses toppled the inner workings of life and changed the very structure of identity, much like the jail cell was already giving Mikovits a different and harrowing vision of what was possible in her life.